You're listening to episode 6 of the Publish the Story podcast, a Christian perspective on reading and writing literature. I'm your host, Kevin Bounds.
One of the editors for my publisher met with me once, and she told me, she said, you know, I love your books because even your secondary and tertiary characters feel completely real to me.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to episode 6 of the Publish the Story podcast. In this episode, I was privileged to record a conversation I had with award-winning author Patrick W. Carr. Patrick Carr starts his day at an absurdly early hour, swilling coffee in an oversized mug and eating dark chocolate as he crafts character-driven fantasy stories in the dark. He was born in what used to be West Germany at the height of the Cold War to an Air Force fighter pilot and a very patient woman. He turned his predilection for daydreaming into a writing habit, which explains why he will often stop mid-sentence to stare, observing scenes no one else can see. His first novel, A Cast of Stones, won the Clive Staple Award, the ACFW Carroll Award, and was a finalist for the Christie Award in two different categories. Since then, his works have won the Realmakers Award for Epic Fantasy and the Inspie Award. He spends his day teaching high school math, yes, really, in Nashville, Tennessee, and his nights enjoying laughter and music with his beautiful wife, Mary, and their four sons. He is the author of two acclaimed series, The Staff and the Sword and The Dark Water Saga. You can find out more about him and his books at patrickwcarr.com, the place where character-driven fantasy lives. Welcome to the show, Patrick.
Thank you for having me. Thank you very much.
I am really excited to have you on. As we were talking just before we began to record, of my aspirations of being a fantasy writer, a speculative fiction writer, and just to be able to talk to somebody that's a little bit further down the road and got books under his belt, I'm just really excited to have you on the show to discuss reading and writing. Before we go any further, I always like to do this to kind of warm everybody up. Tell us a little bit about you. What do you do for fun? What's some things that Patrick Carr would do for fun?
Well, when the weather's good, I like to go cycling or hiking. And regardless of the weather, I like to kind of work on the house. With the coronavirus in play right now, I've had a little more time than usual, so I'm remodeling the basement. So I haven't broken myself for the house so far. I did kind of almost electrocute myself once, so I got to be careful around that. But yeah, those are the things. Surviving, that's what I like to do for fun.
Yeah, I would say surviving. Definitely not a good thing to electrocute yourself. Now, okay, I'm going to ask you some random questions. Coffee or tea?
Coffee in the morning, tea in the afternoon.
Okay. Mexican food or Chinese food?
Mexican food.
Mexican food. Now, I knew that we would get along, okay? I like Chinese food, but I am a sucker for Mexican food, okay? All right, now I'm going to crank it up just a little bit, and this is a controversial one, okay?
Okay.
Tolkien or Lewis?
You can't choose between those two. I mean, it's like asking me which leg do you want you want to cut off of me? Do you want to cut off my left leg or my right leg?
Not saying that either one of them are bad, by no means. They both have their due respect, but Tolkien or Lewis, which one do you lean toward?
Okay, I'm going to qualify. I will say Lewis for the power of the allegory, and I will say Tolkien for his world building.
Gotcha. Totally agree on that one. I knew that would probably. You know, that one's the one that gets people. But anyway, again, like I said, thank you for coming on. And I wanted to jump right into our the ministry of reading literature. Now, a lot of times, you know, people, let's be honest, there's people in today that we live in a more visual society. And unfortunately, not very many people or not a whole lot of people tend to read books like they used to. But when did you realize the impact of literature?
First off, you have to understand that I'm pretty much my whole life, I have been late to the game on everything. So I didn't even learn how to read until I was in third grade. As a matter of fact, I was the worst reader in second grade. I was so bad that my second grade teacher made fun of me because I couldn't spell the word And I don't mean as in U-H, like somebody's pausing. I mean like as in the letter A, as in I want a sandwich. So after I learned how to read in third grade, after that, you couldn't drag me out of a book. And there was, you know, even now, I just remember all the stories I read in elementary school and middle school and high school and college and on after that. And, you know, it's to say that, you know, when did I realize it was powerful? It's more like, you know, when did I encounter different levels of the power of story? And I would say probably the first author whose work really, really hit me was a guy who wrote horse books. His name was Walter Farley. And he would write all these books about horses like Black Stallion. And he wrote one book that was, I thought at the time, was just crazy long, but it was called Man of War. And I found that book when I was in fifth grade. And I read that book like five times just because the story just held on to me so much. So I would say, you know, from the fifth grade on, I was kind of hooked into reading in a pretty big way.
Yeah, that's about the time that I began to read. And I believe Where the Red Fern Grows is the story that really just hammered me. Now, of course, as I spoke about in my introduction episode, that, I mean, my love for reading kind of grew, and then it would wane, and I can think of the days when my wife or my mother, I'm sorry, would take me to the public library, and I'd pick up Curious George books, you know. So reading, our family's always been a bookish people, but I guess as I've got older, I really have just really come to appreciate the power of the written word and story. What are some of the authors and books that have shaped or helped form who you are? Because I believe that we're kind of a product of what we are reading, I guess what you would say. So what authors and books help shape you?
Well, we alluded to a couple of them earlier when we were doing the fun questions. But first, when I was recovering from knee surgery when I was 15, I had a friend of church, an older friend, bring me a copy of a book by C.S. Lewis. And it wasn't actually one of his science fiction books. It was actually The Screwtape Letters. And that was just absolutely enormous. I never knew that you could, you know, take, you know, church stuff or theology and wrap it up into a story that was compelling that way. You know, years later, I found when I was in college, I would use reading as kind of like an escape from the pressures of class. And I went into, I remember, the Georgia Tech bookstore, and I found a little box set of a series called The Chronicles of Thomas Covenant, the Unbeliever. And it wasn't Christian fiction by any means, but it was incredibly well written, and it featured what's commonly called an anti-hero. And it was absolutely amazing. It was my first exposure really to what most people would refer to as fantasy or speculative fiction. And I was staying up until 2 a.m. every night, you know, reading through that series, because it was just so incredibly well written. I mean, the language and the craft of it was just amazing to me. After that, I found Lord of the Rings. I remember I bought a huge red leather bound edition of the Lord of the Rings back in 1980. And it was the Lord of the Rings all in one volume. And I, you know, spent nights and nights and nights reading that until I plowed through it. And you know, I was just so impressed by the depth of world building that went into it, and the, and really just the sense of antiquity that you get when you read that book. It's just, you get this overwhelming sense of like age and how ancient the world was. After that, I found, you know, I would read other books that I thought were very, very compelling, and people whose style I just really enjoyed. You know, I read a lot of detective novels. I loved Sir Arthur Conan Doyle's Sherlock Holmes. I also read a lot of stuff by a contemporary guy named Michael Connelly, who actually writes detective stories. And he's got a series on Amazon called Bosch, which features his main detective, a guy named Harry Bosch, which is excellent. I also read, a series that is what some people would call urban fantasy. It's called The Dresden Files, by a guy named Jim Butcher, who I had the pleasure to meet briefly up in Lexington, about a year ago. And it's just, all I can say about The Dresden Files is like, they're, I wouldn't say they're overly deep, but they are incredibly well crafted, and the best description I can give to those is they're just about like literary crack. They're pretty much a one hit addiction to everybody who picks them up. I've also read, I'm trying to think of the guy David and Goliath, Malcolm Gladwell. He writes nonfiction, but it's just incredibly impactful stuff. Absolutely life-changing. At each phase, I tend to write fantasy, but when I read, I tend to be pretty ecumenical in what I read. I'll read almost anything. I've even read some romance novels that I just really, really enjoyed. So, you know, at every stage of my life, there's always something that's impacting my reading. But I would say that's a very quick and a very brief rundown. Oh, and it wouldn't be complete unless I mentioned a series I've gone back to over and over again called The Belgariad by a gentleman who's no longer with us. His name is David Eddings, and a series called The Wheel of Time, which is incredibly long, but worth the effort, by a guy named Robert Jordan. And it was actually finished off by another guy named Brandon Sanderson.
Okay. While you were listing those books and how you read widely, I'm going to kind of jump ahead a little bit. Now, we'll kind of backtrack in just a second. How do you think that reading widely has influenced your writing? How do you what is the importance of that?
Well, when I actually set out to write, one of the things that I wanted to do was I wanted to take what I thought were the best pieces of different writing genres and blend them together. So one of the things that I did with my first series, which was The Staff and the Sword, was I wanted to take a lot of tropes of the fantasy series, such as, like, you know, young man, humble beginnings, you know, goes through a process called the monomyth, and, you know, conquers a lot of difficulties. But I wanted to take that and I wanted to put a distinctly Christian allegorical spin on that. So what I did with the first series was I took, you know, what a lot of people thought would be a fairly typical story, but I embedded the story within the Christian viewpoint. So if you were to analyze the structure of The Staff and the Sword, you would find yourself reading an almost entirely different story than if you just read it at the surface level. For example, Errol, the main character in The Staff and the Sword, is actually an earthly type of Jesus Christ, which is actually why he has the name Errol, because Errol means wanderer. And You know, to come up with Errol's name, I wanted a name that meant wanderer, because when I was like reading through the Bible and figuring out, you know, how do I make this an allegory? I came across the first verse where Jesus says, the Son of Man has no place to lay his head. Foxes have dens and rabbits have holes or something like that, but the Son of Man has no place. And so I started building all these structures into that series. For example, Errol is the only viewpoint character in the very first book. In the second book, there are two viewpoint characters, Errol and a guy named Potter Martin. Well, Potter means father. So now we have a book where we have two viewpoints, where we have the viewpoint of the son and the viewpoint of the father. And in the third book, we introduce a third viewpoint character, Errol's love interest, whose name happens to be Adora, which is basically just a shortened form of adoration, which is meant to symbolize the Holy Spirit. So now in the progression of the books, we have one point of view character, two point of view characters, and in the final book, we have the three point of view characters that symbolize the Trinity. When I got to my second series, The Darkwater Saga, I had always wanted to write a detective series, but, you know, I was still writing fantasy, and my publisher still wanted me to write fantasy. So I thought, okay, let's do a mashup. And so let's write Sherlock Holmes meets Lord of the Rings. So what you have is you have what's basically a detective series set in a very fantastical type of setting. And, the inspiration for the main character there, a character named Willett Dura, was actually my father, because my father came back from Vietnam with a pretty rough case of PTSD. And I thought, well, what would it be like if we had a detective who had a kind of fantasy form of PTSD, so that as we were watching the story unfold through the lens of his character, we weren't absolutely sure if we were seeing the truth or not. So that became my fantasy suspense kind of mashup with the second series. And so I think that's probably the biggest benefit I've gotten out of reading widely, is that you can pull these different aspects of different genres and you can bring them together. Strangely enough, most people seem to like it.
Yes. It does sound very, very interesting. Now what I'm going to ask you, the impossible question. I've been told that this is the impossible one. If you were asked to suggest one book that you think would help ignite a fire in an individual to read, maybe think of that person that's a non-reader, or, you know, that what book would you suggest to them to say, hey, you've got to read this? And I know there's so many different variables there, but what book would you recommend to that non-reader?
I know it's going to sound cliche or trite, but I would actually begin with the Bible, because even in secular work, even in work that has very little redeeming quality in it, what you are going to find is themes and references to the Bible in that work. Most people don't realize it, but for example, one of the writers or producers of the movie Home Alone actually got the inspiration for that movie out of the Bible, when Jesus left his parents to go sit in the temple, and he was missing for a few days. If you look at our favorite movies, and one of the movies that's my absolute favorite is Field of Dreams. I don't know. I loved baseball as a kid growing up, and wanted to be a professional baseball player before my knees had other ideas. And I cannot walk through a room if that movie is on without sitting down to watch it, even though I've seen it a jillion times. And it doesn't matter how often I've seen the ending where Kevin Costner asks the actor who's playing a younger version of his dad at the end if he wants to play catch at the very end of the movie. You know, I have to watch that, and I get choked up because, you know, what you're seeing is the power of redemption. I mean, and it's a theme that we keep coming back to. You know, the themes that resonate with us most strongly are all laid out for us. You know, sacrifice, redemption, you know, bad choices, second chances. It's all there. The stories are just amazing. And they just, you know, that's really what we're trying to emulate. As writers who are telling a different story, we're trying to capture the impact of that in some small way.
Absolutely. And that's the whole reasoning behind the name of Publish the Story podcast, because I believe that, I like to tell people, I said, we're all captivated by story because we are captured in a story, his story. And it's a grand narrative. And I like to tell people, I said, our whole entire lives is just a subplot of salvation, of the salvation story. And I think that's what people are looking for. I really appreciate you. I don't think it's a cliche answer at all when you look at it in that aspect that the Bible gives us the whole story. You get what I'm saying? It gives us not all the details, but it gives us the patterns. I mean, he is our author, you know? And I think us being writers ourselves are trying to emulate that Imago Dei, you know, the image bearing of God. You know? So I really appreciate you mentioning that. And like I said, I don't know if you realize that or not, but that's the whole concept of this show.
It's a good one to have. It's just, yeah. And for that reason, I'm very, very hesitant to pick up a secular piece of work and criticize it because, you know, first off, you know, it's kind of pointless to expect people who aren't Christian to write through a lens as if they were. That's kind of insane, to be honest. But second off, you know, even people who are not professing Christians have access to the most important themes that bind us all together. I mean, themes of love and sacrifice and redemption. So, you know, this is one of the reasons why I don't lay down rules like, you know, you can only read Christian fiction or, you know, you're not allowed to read anything secular, because it's just, you know, we're missing out on a lot of connections to the people in the world around us if we set up those kinds of walls and barriers.
Absolutely. I mentioned this, I think, in the previous episode, that I believe it was C.S. Lewis that said, you know, reading literature allows us to see through another person's eyes. And if, even though it's great, though, I think that Christians need to be discerning, you know, when they read, but not to the point of, oh, I'm never going to read that because that doesn't come from a biblical worldview. I think we need to know what our worldview is, and that way we can see the redeeming qualities of some of the different literature that we read. I really appreciate your humility on that, because sometimes if we're not careful, we'll put our holy robe on, you get what I'm saying, and say, oh, I can't read this. But really and truly, if it shows us how a person thinks, and it may could be an avenue that we could reach them, you know, or better understand them from where they're coming from. And also, sure, why are we expecting unbelievers to write as believers do? You know, that's insane.
Well, it's awfully hard to make a connection with somebody if you have nothing in common with
them. Yes, absolutely.
So, I mean, if you don't.
Yeah.
Your lives need to intersect somewhere.
And even those books that, and like I said, I'm not saying go and get anything profane or, you know, just vulgar or anything like that. But what I'm saying is even those books that we don't agree with, you know, if it comes from a naturalist mindset or whatever, we can still see the grand things, because those a novel is a worldview. It contains a worldview. There's no way around it. You have to have a worldview, and your worldview will come shining through when you sit down to write a book. So I think that it's a good way, I guess, as one of my former guests said, it's pre-evangelism. You know, if you do write a book and maybe you can reach them on that level. Again, I really do appreciate that comment. So, Patrick, when did you know that you wanted to write?
It was actually after our Mary and I had children. We have four boys. They're all stair steps. They're all about 2 years apart. And I guess it was about the time our youngest was maybe 4 or 5 years old. I got into the habit of reading to them every night. So after dinner and the chores were done, they would gather around and we'd all kind of just, you know, hang out in the den. And I'd find a book to read, and I would read for about 30 minutes or more sometimes if they really wanted me to keep going. And they would just sit there and listen to the story. And I remember we just went through a ton of books. We read The Hobbit, and we read The Flight to the Mushroom Planet, and a whole bunch of kids' books. And then, you know, we read some of my favorite books. And then it dawned on me one day, I thought, you know, what would be really cool is if I could read them a story in which they were the main characters. So I sat down and started writing. And I came up with an utterly forgettable novel called The Legend's Granddaughter, which... what had them as the main characters. They loved it. It wasn't very well written. but you know, that actually, you know, kind of sparked something in me. And I was like, wow, I really, really enjoyed this. I had tried writing before, but I had never been able to finish anything. I would get three chapters in, write myself into a corner and quit. And then I would try a different novel and I would get three chapters in and write myself into a corner and quit. So when I sat down to write, you know, this first novel, Legend's Granddaughter, I actually didn't write anything for 6 weeks. I actually just concentrated on fleshing out the characters, setting up the scenes, and putting together a plot. I wasn't actually writing the story. And it was the first time I was actually able to finish a novel. Cause I had tried for a few years to do it before then and never could. And then after that, I wrote the sequel and then I wrote another sequel. And so, lying in the bottom of my file cabinet are actually, three manuscripts for a series that no one outside my family has read and hopefully will never read because they're rough. But, that was when the bug really hit me. And then, after that, I joined a writer's group and started working the craft of writing. And, when I wrote A Cast of Stones, which is the first book in, the series, The Staff and the Sword, I had no intention for that book to get published. What I was trying to do was just improve myself as a writer. I was trying to see if I could actually write a fantasy novel all from one character's point of view. Because what I noticed J.K. Rowling had done with the Harry Potter series was she had written predominantly from Harry's point of view. Very few other characters were involved. And I thought, wow, that's really kind of a different take, because most fantasy novels have, you know, at least four point of view characters, sometimes more. And I was really kind of fascinated by that. So I sat down to write that as an exercise and went to a writer's conference and pitched that. And, you know, oddly enough, Bethany House, my publisher, expressed interest in that. And about a year later, after a whole lot of editing, they picked it up.
Wow. So is that when you considered yourself a writer after you've after they picked your book up and after you published. When did you consider yourself a writer?
I actually considered myself a writer well before then. I considered myself a writer from the time I completed my very first novel, the one that never got published. Now, the word I hate to use because it just sticks in my throat is author. For some reason, I really just can't use the word. Other people are authors. I'm a writer. Authors are people who've published like 30 or 40 novels. Those guys are authors. I'm basically just a writer. This is, everything that I've done, this is basically a hobby that just got out of hand. So I try to approach this with a measure of humility. I had a friend who went to China once, and when he came back, I asked him what he'd learned, and he looked at me. He said, "Well, Patrick, I found out that you have two choices in life. You can be humble or you can be humbled. Take your pick." And so I thought, if I can be humble, that sounds like that would be a lot better than being humbled.
Yes. Yes, absolutely. Absolutely. So that kind of leads into our next line of questioning. You mentioned that this is just kind of like a hobby that got out of handle. Is there anything else that you would like to share as far as how God directed your writing journey?
Well, I can sure share the price that I paid. I don't know if God was directing this or if God was just allowing me to do something stupid. Sometimes I feel like that's kind of half our conversation. I plant my feet and I decide I'm going to do something a certain way. And despite, every indication to the contrary, and God, I think God looks down and goes, "Okay, that's the way you insist on doing it, you go right ahead. I'll be here waiting for you when you decide to wise up." After I had finished the first series, The Staff and the Sword, it surprisingly had done really well. At one point, the third book in that series, A Draw of Kings, was not only number one for Christian fantasy, it was actually in the top 12 for all fantasy, period. I've got a screenshot of Amazon that shows me A Draw of Kings is right after A Game of Thrones and right before The Lord of the Rings. And it was selling really, really well. And so my publisher and my agent both came back to me and said, "Okay, you're hot. You got to follow it up, and you got to follow it up quick." And they said, "What do you got?" And I said, "Well, I don't actually have anything formalized, but I do have this idea for kind of a fantasy detective series." And they said, "Great, we'll take it." And I didn't even have a plot. I was like, okay, this isn't really formed yet. This was the ultimate Quasimodo. It was just kind of half made. And, against my better judgment, I agreed, because I was new and to the industry, and they were right. I did need to follow up. But I had also, in addition to being a school teacher, I had also just committed to going to grad school to get my master's degree in education. And I thought stupidly that if I just put my head down and bulled my way through this, I could do all three of those. I could teach by day, I could go to grad school on the weekends and at night, and I could get up really early in the morning and I could write The Shock of Night, which was the first book in the Darkwater saga. And what happened is I started to run down. And as I started to basically just kind of get more and more chronically tired, I substituted coffee and sugar for regular sleep. And I got into this spiral where that got worse and worse and worse. And by the time I got to the end of it, I was so upside down and so tired. I honestly didn't care if I lived or died. I was just completely exhausted. And there was a moment, that was kind of a watershed moment where I was in the kitchen. And for months I've been running on 3 or 4 hours sleep a night. And even on nights when I could sleep more, my body wouldn't let me. I would wake up at 1 a.m. in the morning and just be wide awake and not be able to go back to sleep. And I was exhausted in the kitchen, getting ready to go to school to teach. And Mary walked in and I was just absolutely done. And I just started crying and just told her, I am so tired. And you know, we just had to make some changes. I got through the series and I made a change in some of my routines and we found a doctor who finally figured out how to get me fixed. So it finally came together. So I can't say God was directing me along that path, so much as he kind of rescued me off of it. The thing is like, you know, you can set success up as an idol, just like you can anything else. And, you know, you can achieve it, but it'll break you too. I mean, I know my favorite authors, I'm watching those guys and I see their pictures over the course of a few years and I'm going, watching them look more and more tired, watching them put on unhealthy weight. And I'm like, okay, I know exactly what's going on there. If you're not careful, you know, the pursuit of success, especially when you're writing and trying to hold down a day job, you know, it will age you in dog years. That's probably not the answer you were expecting.
No, it's good. It's good. I mean, one of the things, as I mentioned before, I was in pastoral ministry and I've been in situations like that where you just stretch yourself really, really thin and it's key to find a balance, you know, and try to balance everything. And sometimes that means just letting good stuff go, you know, just saying, hey, look, I can't do it all, you know, and just have to be satisfied with what we can do. You know, but I really do appreciate that. Now, moving a little bit further, we've alluded to it a couple times. I mentioned it in your bio, and one of the things I love to ask is, what does your writing process look like? I know that it's different for every writer; everybody's unique. But what does your writing process look like?
Well, I've been to a lot of writing classes, especially at the writers' conferences and stuff, and most people think of writing as a continuum where you've got the extreme plotter on one side and you've got what's called a pantser over on the other side. So some people write out a very, very exhaustive plot and outline, and only after that's done do they actually start writing the novel. The most extreme of the example of that I ever heard of was one of my favorite political thriller novelists, who wrote a guy named Robert Ludlum, who wrote a bunch of books back in the 80s and 90s. And, you know, he would write such an exhaustive plot and outline that basically when he was done with the first draft, he was done. And he needed very, very little polishing or editing. And then you've got people all the way over at the other end of the spectrum who just sit down and they start writing and they write by the seat of their pants and they end up having to go back and do a lot of editing, a lot of rewriting, a lot of shuffling around, a lot of transitional scenes and things like that. I am not. And then you've got people who are all sorts of places in between. I tend to write not along the continuum, but like at a third point that makes a triangle. I will actually write a plot and a rough outline. But what I do then is instead of like fleshing out a very, very detailed outline, I flesh out very, very detailed characters. And I will spend weeks, even months thinking about my characters and coming up with everything about my characters. where they're from, what they like, what they don't like, what their fears are, what they hope for most, what they dread, what their secrets are, everything about them. So that by the time I start a book, my characters are as real to me as my friends are. And I know them as well. And they're all distinct, and they have nervous tics, and they have things that they say, turns of speech, phrases, that kind of thing. And then what I do is I take my characters and I put them into the beginning of a novel, and I throw the inciting incident into them. And from that point on, I let my characters react the way they would exactly as if they were real people. And one of the most fun things about that is that I will write the novel from that point, and my characters will surprise me because they will do something I totally did not expect, but is absolutely in keeping with their character. It's a very, very strange mindset, because in those cases, I don't really feel like I'm writing the novel so much as I'm taking dictation from someone else who's telling me what's supposed to go on to the page. And it's new to me. It's not like I'm thinking of it. It's like I'm just kind of passing it along. And one of my publishers, one of the editors for my publisher, met with me once, and she told me, she said, "You know, I love your books because even your secondary and tertiary characters feel completely real to me. You know, there's nothing," you know, she said she'd read a lot of books and the characters will feel a little bit two-dimensional, like they're cardboard cutouts. But she would tell me how real my characters felt. And it was a compliment that I'd gotten quite often. So that's why I tend to brand myself as a guy who writes character-driven fantasy. The plot is kind of secondary to what's happening with my people.
Yeah, that's very interesting. As you were mentioning that, I was thinking, is there a way that you capture these? Is there a system that you use? Is there a filing cabinet? How do you craft these characters, and how do you keep them? Because one of the things I've run into is sometimes you mention things at the beginning of a manuscript, and then at the end you're like, wait a minute, you know, that's not keeping with their character. How do you keep in track of all that?
Well, as far as the nuts and bolts of keeping track of the character goes, I keep what's called a style sheet. And basically it tracks the details of that character, so that, you know, I don't allow the character, we stay consistent within the character. But as far as making the character real, usually I will go down and I will try to come up with a theme for the novel. For example, for the Staff and the Sword, that whole series, one of the themes in that was everybody has secrets and most of them are deadly. So I had every single character in there, even though they all had their own personality, everybody had something that they were trying to hide or they were trying to help someone else to hide. And then I went through and I started looking at those characters, and I would start asking really, really painful questions. And this is the quickest way I can think of for any new writer to give their characters depth. Ask yourself these questions about your character. What are they trying to hide? What do they want most in the entire world? What set of circumstances would lead them to forsake all their morals and principles and ethics? And the answer to those three questions frames an incredibly vivid character, because those three questions are things that most of us won't even answer out loud. Certainly not in front of strangers. But it makes for delightful writing.
That's great advice. Is there any more advice that you would like to give beginning writers, or either either that rider that's kind of further down the road, you know, that maybe is just kind of at a point where asking themselves, am I really cut out for this?
Ride every day, even though I'm not following that one at this point. I'm taking a rest. but if you're actively pursuing it, you have to ride every day. And you have to put in the word count. Nobody's a good rider to start off with. It takes work, it takes editing, and it just takes time. So you have to ride every day. And the next thing is you have to be not cruel to your own riding, but you have to be absolutely merciless to your riding. You know, if there is something that needs to be fixed, then you work and you fix it. You don't just, if you know that there's a problem in a scene, you don't leave the problem and just hope that nobody else is going to notice. If it doesn't read true, you have to fix it. Now, you've also got to give yourself a measure of grace. When I wrote the second book in The Staff and the Sword, The Hero's Lot, when I finished that book, I realized that at that point in time, that was the absolute best that I could write. Because I thought The Hero's Lot was a better book than A Cast of Stones, which was, you know, which it was the sequel to. And I thought, okay, someday I know I'm going to be a better writer, but right now this is the absolute best that I can do because I really loved that book. And then I finished off The Staff and the Sword and I started on the next series, the Darkwater series, and wrote The Shock of Night, which I enjoyed. And then when I wrote The Shattered Vigil, which was, again, the sequel to The Shock of Night, I thought, wow, that is absolutely the best that I can write. Even if I had more time and go back, this is the best product that I can do. So, you know, there's this measure of, you know, are you putting out the very best that you can at that moment in time? And if you are, then great. And then just accept that and move on. If you're not, go back and fix it.
Gotcha. I gotcha. You mentioned that you're a part of a writer's group, and that's one of the things that I've attempted to form where I'm at. And that's one of the reasons why I chose to do this podcast is because it gets me in contact with other writers, you know, to kind of discuss writing and to learn myself. But for those people that maybe are not near a writer's group or maybe they're in a writer's group, but what books, craft books, would you suggest? Or and it doesn't necessarily have to be craft books, but on the craft of writing, what books would you recommend that would, you know, help fellow writers?
I've got like most writers, I've got a bunch of them because despite knowing better, I'm still looking for that magic bullet. But the one that I always keep coming back to, and I've almost worn the cover off of it, I've gone back to it so often, is a book called Stein on Writing. It's by a guy named Saul Stein, S-O-L-S-T-E-I-N, Saul Stein. And it is commonly acknowledged for decades as kind of like the go-to book for craft. I mean, and it covers everything. Characterization, plotting, you know, the whys behind we do what we do, how to write really good scenes. And, you know, when I'm in between books and I'm kind of in that phase where I'm exploring my characters and I'm trying to come up with a good plot and I'm trying to kind of see my way forward, that's the book that I go back to.
And that was Stein on Writing?
Stein on Writing. He also wrote another one that's very good. I don't like it quite as much, called How to Grow a Novel.
How to Grow a Novel. I'll try to look those up and put those in the show notes that way as resources. I appreciate that. Is there any other?
There's another one. I can't remember the author's name, but it's called The First Five Pages. And it's basically, it's a very short book, but it's basically tells you why your manuscript's getting rejected so fast. If you send in a manuscript to an editor or an agent, if you're lucky, they'll give you 5 pages. So if you can't hook them in the first 5 pages, you're not going to hook them at all. It's like now, if like people who review movies, you get maybe 5-10 minutes of a movie before people go, I'm not interested in this, if that.
Okay, I'll try to look those up and put those in the show notes for others that are listening. Now, is there anything else that you would like to talk about? Of course, I'll put links to your books and the show notes as well. And as I mentioned before, I'm working my way through Cast of Stones. I'm looking forward to now I get to see a little bit more and try to find out what secrets they're hiding. I really appreciate that. Is there anything else that you'd like to say to our fellow writers out there?
Well, I would just say, we live in an interesting time where it seems like people read less and less. But that doesn't mean that there aren't avenues for good writing. It's just that a lot of the writing is going, the markets are kind of shifting away from traditional books per se, but are probably shifting towards visual media. So, Amazon and Netflix and Redbox, all of these people have a tremendous appetite for good stories. So it may be that instead of writing, classic novels, it may be that, writers may have to start, exploring screenplays. I know, there's a local agent here who I've been friends with for years. She actually has a meeting every year, every other year, where she takes some of her writers on a cruise and they get to hobnob with editors and purchasers from Netflix and Amazon. And they're looking for stories that they can turn into series.
That's an interesting point. I haven't really thought about that, but that is a definitely high market, those who feel called to write and to influence people with their writing. And of course, a movie or a show, has great potential to influence. As a matter of fact, it's one of the most influential mediums that we have today. So that's a very good point. Well, at this time, I want to ask you one more thing. If someone was looking for you online, social media handles or anything like that, where can they find you at?
I'm on Instagram and I'm on Twitter and I'm on Facebook. And they can just find me under Patrick W. Carr. I've also got a website that links to all of those. I'm not on social media a whole lot right now. I'm kind of taking a social media break. My most recent novel released back in November. And once we got through release season, I told myself I was going to take a well-earned break from all the publicity and that kind of thing. So, but I'm out there. So if somebody wants to read my stuff and get a hold of me, they can certainly do that.
Okay. I'll put links in the show notes as well. Now, Patrick, there's one thing that I always like to ask a guest if they're comfortable doing it. To close us out with a word of prayer for those who are listening to this show, those that maybe are just new to reading, and then also that writer, whether they're a beginner or somewhere in the middle, or that seasoned writer that just needs some encouragement. Would you mind closing us out with a word of prayer?
I would not mind at all. Okay. So for those of you who are within the sound of my voice, live or recorded, let's bow our hearts. Our Father, we thank you so much for this time together. I pray an encouragement for all the people out there who are struggling to find their voice as writers, who are struggling to find the energy, who are struggling to find the inspiration. Lord, I ask that you would be with them and you would lead them where you want them to go for their story and for their writing, either as a vocation or an avocation, Lord. I ask that you would inspire them to write stories that touch hearts and that change lives. And Lord, I ask that you would also give them a sense of balance, Help them to replenish, Lord, so that they can do the work that you have given them to do. Shine your favor on us all, Lord, in this time of the coronavirus. In your name we pray. Amen.
Thank you so much, Patrick.
You are more than welcome. Thank you for having me.
You've been listening to the Publish the Story podcast with Kevin Bounds. You can find the resources mentioned during this episode in the show notes. If you've enjoyed today's content, please consider subscribing to the podcast in either Apple or your favorite podcast app. By subscribing to, giving a star rating, or even a written review, this helps the podcast rank in iTunes and helps others find the show. Again, thank you for listening to Publish the Story podcast. You can find more information at kwbounds.com/publish the story. While there, look around my site and sign up for my mailing list for exclusive offers and resources. Until next time, this is Kevin Bounds saying, go write and publish the story.